Mike, you're absolutely right about the difference for the difference in a mixed is that, it worked out nicely for me because I got Trout, McCutchen, and Kane at my price. But if I had lost out on, one or two of those guys, and I was going through, the second round without a player, and I saw the prices for these stars were going all across the board higher than I thought they were going to, I would have at that point. That's when you have to adjust in a mixed.
Dawn, here's to us November and the waning sun, and all the proofs I'd like to prove. We go down tonight.
Good evening and welcome to episode 82 of Flags Fly Forever, a baseball prospectus fantasy podcast. I am your host, Brett Sayer, and with me as always is Mike Ginella and George Bissell. So we all saw each other this weekend. That's different. We don't usually record coming off of seeing each other IRL. George, how was your train back?
It was good. I had a lot of fun. It was really, first of all, we've been doing this show for almost a year now, and I've been at BP a year, and I'd never actually met either of you in person, so it's nice to put the old a face to the name, sort of. Yeah, I had a lot of fun, and just meeting everyone in the industry is really cool. There's a lot of great guys who do that. You could talk to Lorne Michaels for like 2 hours. Like, he'll talk to you forever if you let him. So,
I think he did talk to us for 2 hours. We were at the mixed like right at the beginning and left a little after five. I went back to my hotel to kind of rest before going to Foley's, and yeah, we talked to him most of the time. Yeah, he's a pisser.
Yeah, and then also getting to talk with Tristan Cockcroft. I think I might have talked about it with Billy Hamilton with him for like an hour. It was a lot of fun at Foley's, and it's great. If you've never been to Tout Wars, you should go, because it's awesome.
Yeah, and there's just way too many people to mention, like great people in the industry that were both at the auctions and, who we got to see at Foley's. So, yeah, it's a wonderful weekend, and, if you're in New York or in the area and can make it out, you should. It's just to the Foley's part, really, it's a lot of fun.
Plus, we had some pretty cool draft action, which I'm excited to talk about as well. It's gonna be
that's a great segue.
We did all buy some players, and in addition to buying some drinks, so let's talk about it for a while before we get started. You can find all of us at baseballprospectus.com. You can find us on Twitter. I am at Dynasty Guru. Mike is at Mike Gianella. That's G-I-A-N-E-L-L-A. And George is at George Bissell. It's two S's and two L's. Email us at flagsflyforever@baseballprospectus.com and rate and review us on things. So let's take a real quick break, and then we'll come back and talk lots and lots of tout. And we're back. We flipped a coin before we got started, and we are going to talk about the mixed auction first, which I participated in, and then we're going to move our way over to the National League only league that Mike is in, and that Mike is the defending champion of. So the mixed auction was on Saturday afternoon over at the Sirius Studio, just like all of the other auctions were, and it was a lot of fun. It was I won't lie, it was a more enjoyable auction experience than doing X last year in the middle of the open crowded bar at what was the name of that place that we were at last year that they did
Crab, something with Crab,
City Crab. That's where it was.
I don't want to get into, we have a long podcast, so I don't want to go too crazy with this, but the room was actually better it was in that I was in, but where X was, you guys were kind of, it looked like a nightclub. It just wasn't really the best place to do a draft or an auction. Like, it was kind of dim and there was a lot of noise. Like, we were actually in a conference room. You guys were almost like the junior drafters.
Yeah, you guys had the nice setup. We were we were rubbing elbows with everybody with all of New York.
But
this is a different experience. That was a new league. Everyone was feeling out the new format. And this year I was thrown into a group of people who had been, drafting together or auctioning together for a while. So, I had to do a little bit of additional prep work, I think, beforehand, just to see sort of how the room has played in previous years, just to get a little bit of a sense of what to expect. And it turned out that was pretty much all for naught. I looked at the last couple of years of how people spent their money, and it ended up being different enough this year that I think everyone was on, if not similar footing to me as they were on, reasonably similar footing, in that it was a little off kilter from what I think everyone was used to. So, part of the challenge of it was that, and I've seen this across, I wrote about this in my recap, it's up at BP. I've seen this in a couple of other people's recaps, is that the beginning of the auction started out pretty expensive. And, it was the kind of thing where I had gone in with my bid limits, and we'll talk about sort of what my process was after. And the way I put them together, I was anticipating to do a little bit more of a Stars and Scrubs strategy than I ended up doing, but I was still able to get a handful of stars with the money that I did spend. I got Mike Trout, I got Andrew McCutchen. Those are two pretty good strongholds especially for an on base league. And honestly, going into the draft, I thought I would end up with 4 to 5 players that were in the $22 to $25 range or higher. And I ended up with 3. I ended up with those two outfielders and Lorenzo Cain for $23. So I ended up sitting a little bit on, I ended up sitting on a little bit more money than I thought I was going to. And, it put me in the situation that I don't like to be at the end of an auction where, I had control of the room at the very end while I was filling out my roster, but not in the most optimal way.
Can I ask you something before we go on?
Sure.
I talk a lot about my auction process, and over the last couple of years we've done this podcast. With X last year, since that was a draft, and since. We kind of talk about broader topics. I haven't really talked to you about, how you prepare for auctions, Brett. So I kind of want to ask, like, do you come in with a plan where you say, I'm looking to spend 200 on offense and 60 on pitching, or I need to get, this with catchers, or I need to get that? Or is it really more a matter of value where it's like, okay, well, I have some goals, but, if the value takes me somewhere else, I don't necessarily mind. And I'm talking about a startup, of course, and not a keeper league where, it's different.
Yeah, I generally have an idea of where I think an auction is going to take me based on my valuations and based on my prices. But we've talked about this a lot, and you saw behind the curtain of my process this time. I sent you my spreadsheet. I was walking you through it a little bit. It's not that I went in with a plan to spend $210 on hitting, and I didn't plan to really the spreadsheet was a 68-32 split, and honestly at this point I've been making auction spreadsheets for long enough that I don't really go back and wreck the hitting pitching split unless it's really, really off. So if I feel like pitchers are worth a little bit more of the budget, I'll slide a little bit over there. If I feel like hitters are worth a little bit more of the budget, I'll slide it over there depending on the year. I don't think this year was particularly pulled one way or another. I was a little bit lower on some of the higher end pitching, but I was a little higher on some of the mid level pitching, and part of that is a little bit of a philosophy thing from my end, where I don't like to put all of my starting pitching risk into one basket, even though there are plenty of starters who are lower risk and towards the top than some of the middle guys. But I like to try to spread around the risk with starters whenever I can, and still try to pull some upside. I created my bid limits with all the players. I had all my numbers adding up to the total amount that was in the room, and I create my spreadsheet so that I can calculate what's going on in the room on the fly, whether there's an auction inflation or deflation depending on how I've created my values, and then I just go from there, just start updating my spreadsheet as people get bought, and seeing what I'm comfortable spending on the players that come out.
Yeah. Now, besides the big guys that you bought, and I'm a big fan of the Kane buy, and I probably will grab him anywhere that I can this year. You threw out a couple guys early, like for a buck or two, and you wind up getting them. I just want to ask you about that, like what your thought process was, like why you did that. And just talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, the reason why I did that, it's funny. The first player that I threw out in the auction, I had the second throw behind Fred, who was the defending champion, and I threw out Andre Ethier for $2, and I got him for $2, and that was sort of my way of locking in a guy who I like at the back end, and being able to just kind of fill a roster spot in a way that I felt comfortable at the beginning of the draft. Part of the reason why I did that with him and then I did it with Jimmy Rollins at a dollar a couple rounds later is that I, based on what I had seen of previous years, I thought I was going to be spending more heavily at the beginning. So I ended up underestimating the bargains at the end of the draft. And, some of that is just, what's going to happen. And, it's not even that it's disappointing, because you're locking in something early, and anytime you can lock in something early that you're comfortable with, you're much better off doing that than waiting for something that might be slightly more comfortable later. But, it allowed me to play around with a little bit more money on a per player basis as I was going through the auction. So, I bought Trout and McCutchen and Kane, but I had Ethier and Rollins in there. It sort of balanced out how much I had left to spend on players, and made it more comfortable to spend money in the middle of the auction.
Yeah, what I'd really kind of like to emphasize to our listeners, when I talk about auctions, it's only formats, and I really drive home valuation. And anyone who's listened to this podcast for the last 82 or 83 episodes knows that, but in a mixed, value is certainly important. And Brett's spreadsheet, I can tell you, I did see it. It was like really impressive. You do have to be more flexible in a mix, because there is a greater difference of opinion. It is kind of why stars and scrubs is important. It's why, while pricing is certainly important to a degree, I was kind of watching that auction. I've watched it the last few years. There's just so many different opinions, and there's so many more people trying to get their guys that, while Brett, you know, I think you did a good job, and I liked the way you adjusted it and picked up some players as you went along. To me, like, being rigid, you know, we saw that, I think, with Scott Swanee a couple of years ago when he wound up with, like, a ton of money left on the table. If you're too rigid, that's what's going to happen. So, you know, Brett, I think you did a really good job adjusting to that. You know, and even though maybe you could have pooled like two or three, you know, of your buys into one player, I still really like your team.
Yeah, there were one or two players afterwards that I thought I could have gone the extra dollar or two on, but you know, it wasn't the kind of thing where I thought it really was a detriment to the team that I ended up with. I think my team could have been incrementally better if I had, you know, if I had gone an extra dollar for Anthony Rendon or maybe Cole Hamels or one of the players who I was really considering going the extra dollar for. And you know, Mike, you're absolutely right about the difference for the difference in a mixed is that, you know, it worked out nicely for me because I got Trout, McCutchen, and Kane at my price. But if I had lost out on, you know, one or two of those guys, and I was going through, you know, the second round without a player, and I saw the prices for these stars were going all across the board higher than I thought they were going to, I would have, at that point, that's when you have to adjust in a mixed. You can kind of hang around, and we'll talk about this when we get to the NL only. You can hang around for, you know, 3, 4, 5 rounds without buying a player in an only league if you're confident in how you've set up your values. If you do that on a mixed, you might love your values, but you might just get screwed anyway.
Well, you could buy a team with $260 in value that you spend $200 on. That's the problem.
Yep.
And that's a 7-place team. So it's a clever thing to do, but it's not what you want to do.
Yeah, there's a time and a place for cleverness, and if it's the entire auction, then you've done something wrong,
right?
So, George, I'm curious to get some of your individual thoughts on pieces of this. I wrote out sort of how, you know, the different phases I found myself in during the auction in my write up, but As far as catchers in a two catcher mixed league go, what did you notice about the prices in general in the league, and how do you think my catching pair stacks up with some of the other teams?
I like how you handled it, Brett. I think that you need to be a little more aggressive with a two-catcher format, because I think a lot of the experts are going to go into the strategy that they're going to try and get that second catcher cheap later on in the draft. So I think it does pay off a little bit to be more aggressive, and I think you saw that with how you ended up with two. And I think Darnold, for the price that you got him, I thought that was pretty good value. So I like the approach, and I think that's the way you have to handle a two catcher, because I think everyone's trying to look for that value on the second catcher. And I think if you're a little more aggressive and you've built that into your approach going in, I think that can pay off for you. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think if I remember correctly, I think Darnold was maybe the fifth or the sixth catcher brought out in the auction. So, you know, there were some players that went after him that I think I probably would have preferred at their price, but all things considered, I mean, I like Darnold a lot. We've talked about him. We've talked about him quite a bit. You know, the problem with him is really just health. And if he stays healthy to play in 100 games, I think he earns that $10 pretty easily.
I think the biggest takeaway for me when I looked at your draft, I mean, Mike and I were there watching, and when you guys took a break, you had the big trifecta there in the outfield. You had Trout, Kutch, and Kane, and I think you came out and talked to us about how, you know, just having that cushion with the OBP, having, you know, that stable base, the foundation there, I think that allowed you to take a little more of a risky approach to the rest of the roster. So I think that was big. That was probably one of my biggest takeaways. And then how mid-draft you sort of shifted your approach on pitching. And I think that was those are the two big things for me that I looked at while it was happening that I noticed that I thought were interesting storylines from your draft to watch.
Yeah, so let's talk about the pitching a little bit, because that seemed to be what everyone wanted to talk about with me after the draft. So in eyeballing this, well, I did not spend double digits on a single pitcher, either a starter or a reliever. And the staff that I ended up with, I thought was a pretty solid middle of the road starting staff for a 15 team mixed league. Mike, knowing what I spent in total on this pitching staff, would you expect this collection of arms to be better or worse or about the same in a 15 team mixed?
I would expect it to be worse based on the amount of money that you spent on it versus what it actually is. Like you don't, you know, and you know, people have read the article can see this, but you don't have an ace per se, but you have a number of pitchers with what I would call lift with upside or the potential to maybe do that. Like Carlos Martinez at 9 is somebody who if he's healthy could be an ace. Francisco Liriano, you know, if the good Liriano comes out, could be an ace. Steven Matz is somebody who maybe not an ace, but he could be like a number 2. There's a lot of upside with these guys, and you know that term gets bandied about too much, and I really hate that term. But again, in a mixed league, there's two things to me about this. One, even more so than in an only, I don't like the idea of spending more than say like $80 on a pitching staff. Offense, I feel like, is where the values are more solid. And the second part of that is even in a 15-team mix, and we saw this in labor last year, you can find pitchers. You can pick pitchers up during the season. That's harder to do in a 15-team mix with hitting. So I like what you did from the standpoint of the pitchers you got, but I also like what you did from the standpoint of allocating that money towards your offense.
Yeah, I think, you know, part of what ended up happening there is that, you know, I used that pitching staff as an opportunity to backfill with some additional arms in the reserve round. So where, you know, there are risky, I do have some slightly riskier arms. You know, there's all the shoulder stuff with Carlos Martinez. There's now shoulder stuff with Kevin Gausman. You know, Steven Matz, who knows how many innings he's going to throw. Same with Asashi Iwakuma. Jordan Zimmermann has, you know, I still understand why people think Jordan Zimmermann is going to decline as rapidly as people are pricing him at. But, you know, he's certainly not the $20 pitcher he used to be. So, you know, being able to backfill with some additional guys that I really like in the reserve round, getting someone like Wade Miley, who is really nothing special, but pitching in Safeco, he is, you know, he's a just slightly above replacement level pitcher that I think is going to be healthy all year, and pitch reasonably well and well enough for me to roster pretty much all year. And then some guys with some upside. I mean, I can't draw myself away from Martin Perez. I think he's going to have a really good year this year, second year coming off Tommy John. I grabbed Zach Wheeler, not because I'm in love with Zach Wheeler, but because he makes for a really nice DL stash considering the rules of the league. That means I get another freebie spot before the season starts. And you know, I got to grab Tyler Skaggs, which is someone who I've been trying to grab up pretty much everywhere. I think him with that team and that ballpark and defense behind him, I think he could have a really solid first season back and throw, you know, 150 to 160 really, really strong innings for Los Angeles.
You know what I think stands out to me is when you look at your roster, Brett, and what you spent on the pitchers that you bought, you didn't have really any dollar guys. I mean, if you look at some of the staffs, I mean, they're filled out with guys for several guys for a buck or two, and it's I think you were able to get a little bit more by having that surplus there in terms of money left over towards the end, that you were able to get a few better arms at the back end of the draft than I think some of the rest of the guys who are filling out their staffs at that point. So, I mean, like, if you look at Zimmerman for eight, Iwakuma for six, Mats for six, I mean, if you didn't have the kind of money there, you're going in with, like, a Nate Eovaldi type and Erasmo Ramirez, Aaron Nola. So I think just having that little bit extra there actually was a pretty good thing to have there at the end.
Yeah, it was useful, but it was too much extra. Mm-hmm. Like, I think I could have... Even disregarding any additional players I could have bought, I think I could have purchased this team for $254.
Yeah.
Which means that, you know, yeah, I spent all my money, but I didn't spend all my money in the way that you want to leave your auction having spent all of your money.
Who's the biggest name pitcher that you were the closest to getting that you didn't?
Nicole Hamels.
Yeah.
I like Hamels a lot. I had Hamels valued at $18, and the number didn't quite come out of my mouth in time to get in at 18, and I decided not to go above my number at that point. I came close to getting him. I thought for a second I was going to get Noah Syndergaard at 20, which didn't end up happening. I thought I might have gotten Johnny Cueto at 15, which didn't end up happening. I was really hopeful that I could get Adam Wainwright, but he ended up going out of my price range. Those were a couple of the pitchers who, going in, I knew I was a little bit higher on than the crowd. But you know, the rising tide lifts all boats, and those pitching prices just went up across the board. It didn't leave me with the opportunity to spend my money in the way I thought was most optimal at the time.
My favorite buy, Danny Valencia. He's a stud.
That was the last $7 of my auction.
I like him.
That was it. I was debating between I had David Wright, Danny Valencia, and Pablo Sandoval all on my board, and I knew I could choose which one I wanted.
Mm. Well, you got Sandoval anyway in the reserve, so you do have a little insurance if Valencia just doesn't do anything.
Well, I do.
Yeah.
The thing I look at with your offense, like putting something that I've never done, but now that I'm looking at this, I'm kind of doing, you know, so we had our labor mixed draft, and I'm comparing your offense based on where these guys went in various rounds. And I know it's, you know, it's apples to oranges, but you have a lot of players here, like with the exception perhaps of Mike Napoli, where if you slotted them in by round, it's a very good offense. Like this offense could, if not sweep all five categories, it could finish toward the top in all five categories. You're very strong. You know, obviously, injuries and whatnot can play a factor. But this looks like an offense to me that could finish with like 65 points.
Well, that's the goal. The goal is really to get to 65 with the offense. And I think it's doable. And you talk about Napoli. Napoli's a funny one. Napoli's a guy who swings pretty heavily from average to on base. So that's
a good point.
That's not super surprising when you do the labor to tout comp.
Yeah, he went from a lot more in the AL too. I think in the AL he's been like barely going for anything in the BA leagues, and then at on base he went for like double. So yeah, that's par for the course.
Yeah, well, he was no joke last year. I mean, last year after it was a small sample in Texas, but even in Boston when he was, you know, quote unquote, really struggling, he had a .307 on base and 13 homers in 329 at bats. And if that's the crappy Napoli, and that's the absolute floor, which I think it probably is. I mean, that was his worst performance in 9 years.
Yeah, he's one of those players, you know, I mean, he's at the age where he could just fall off the cliff, but barring that, he's one of those players I do feel has been kind of underrated. Like, even in batting average leagues, I've seen him, like, go, you know, in a 15 team, go on reserve or go undrafted, and it's just kind of like, what? Like, I don't really get it.
Yeah, and then after the trade, he had 295, 396, 513. Mm-hmm. For Texas, it was in 91 play appearances, but you know, it's the point is that he's not. I mean, he's only 30. Has he turned 34 yet? He has turned 34. He'll be 34 this entire season, so yeah. He's not cooked. And
no.
You know, progressive field is not a bad place to hit.
No, and to get back to my point though, that your offense really doesn't have. You know, sometimes you look at teams. Obviously, it's a matter of opinion. But I look at some teams and I see what I'd call like replacement level players on active rosters. Now that can be fixed, but I don't really see that with your team, Brett. Like I see, and particularly with the on-base format, I see a lot of guys who, have value and look like players that belong, you know, as starters in a 15-team mixed league.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, so that's, you know, that's more or less the ins and outs of my team. I mean, In the end, it's going to have to be a very high end offense and middle of the road, more or less, pitching staff that can get me to contention. But you know, I think I left the auction thinking that at least I hadn't lost the league in the auction, and that's all. That's all you really want. I feel pretty good about how this all came together, even if it wasn't 100% optimized, just because, you know, you never fully optimize an auction. You can kind of kick yourself over a couple of things here and there, but if it's really only a couple of things scattered across the draft and a couple of dollars here and there you wish you had spent differently, then that means things probably went pretty well. You guys have any other questions for me before we move on to the National League?
What did you think of the Kershaw Scherzer tandem? Because that happened pretty early in the draft. I want to say like the first round or two that went down.
Yeah, to be honest, I didn't even know that the same person had bought both of them until until the first break, and someone was talking about it. But you know, that's just one of those things when you're in the middle of an auction, it's a little tough to track who exactly is building what kind of team. But
yeah.
Derek was buying Derek Van Riper was buying players early, and he ended up with he ended up with Goldschmidt and Kershaw and Scherzer and Cargo and Fielder and Rendon, and then his roster sort of looked a little bit more on the back end like I thought mine might have looked like coming into the draft. Mm-hmm. But you know, looking at that roster and looking at my roster, I don't feel like I'm in worse position than him having held on and spread out my money a little bit more than I thought I was going to.
That's a good point. I like your team though overall. You have an impressive poker face as well. Mike and I were talking about that at the draft.
You guys can see my poker face from outside the room.
Well, SiriusXM has what they call that conference room. Is for our listeners, it's called the fishbowl. And it really is that, because you can, if you're sitting outside of it, there's like a little waiting area. You can see everybody. It's just a great view of that area.
It is a fun venue. It's tough to squeeze 15 drafters into that room, though.
Yeah, town NL with 12 was more manageable.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
Yeah.
With that, let's move on to the National League. So, Mike, you want to walk us through what defending champion does in their auction?
Apparently, the defending champion has a really weird auction. So, you know, this year we kind of – a lot of people with the AL and the NL. Brett, you have the disadvantage with mixed. There is no other mixed auction to compare to. So you're kind of going in, you know, like you said, looking at past auctions. You probably looked at drafts like labor to, you know, labor mix to kind of see how things might shake out. But as far as setting prices, it's really difficult because you're sort of going by feel. In the NL and the AL, we have the advantage of looking at what happened in the AL and the NL and kind of using that as a baseline. On-base changes things a little bit, but what I decided to do was to kind of pump up some prices, but also knew that there was some conservatism in the past in tout, so I kind of wanted to be careful. So I thought I was going to have the problem of buying two players early for like $80 and not wanting to fall into a trap of, you know, stars and scrubs. The complete opposite happened. I didn't buy a player until about the fifth or sixth round, and it wasn't even a heavy hitter. It was Aaron Nola at $9. And all of these hitters just went sailing by. I wasn't in early for the most part on hitters. I was watching Paul Goldschmidt go for 43, which was my price. And, you know, as you said, Brett, it goes so fast. And once I could have said 44, but I'm like, you know what? It's early enough that I'm going to kind of wait. I was in on D. Gordon, and he went for 30 to Gray Albright of Rasball. And he was kind of another one. I was like, you know, maybe I should have been in on him, but I wasn't. And what wound up happening before the break is I got Aaron Nola and a bunch of other pitchers. I got two closers in Harris Familia and Mark Melancon at 17 apiece. I got Adam Wainwright for 18, and I got Steven Matz for 12. I think this is either before I got a hitter or maybe I got Jonathan Lucroy for 17. So right before the break, the second hitter I got was Brandon Phillips for 13. You know, at this point, all these hitters were off the board, and it was pretty clear that, you know, at one point I'm like, I'm not going to have a hitter over $30. I bid 30 on Charlie Blackman, and Ray Guilfoyle bid 31 and beat me on him. But then suddenly I was wondering if I wasn't even going to have a hitter over 20 because, or anybody over 20, because the players just were flying off so fast, and they were all over by prices. You know, to your point earlier, Brett, about, you know, value. I went on SiriusXM during the break, and, you know, we talked. I knew I'd get value on the team because my prices were correct. I just kind of wondered what the team would look like, and I knew that I was going to have to do some things that were going to look very unconventional.
Like drafting four catchers?
Yeah, like drafting four catchers. So
I had to bring it up.
Well, I was going to bring it up at some point. You know, that was a big topic of conversation, so... One of the things I have noticed in earlier auctions is that catchers have been, you know, kind of conservative. And Lucroy wasn't even a target of mine. He was the only player early where I went a little bit off price just because, you know, I wasn't nervous exactly. I was like, you know, he's somebody who he went for 20 in labor on base. He has some on base skills. I thought I'd say 17 and, you know, he just sailed past it. And when I got him, I was like, all right, you know, Lucroy at 17. He wasn't a guy I was looking at that price, but that's okay. And I just suspected that there was going to be a bit of a lull after the break and some catchers came out. And first, you know, I know Brett likes this. You know, he likes this player. I got Yasmani Grandal for 15, which if the forearm contusion he has today isn't serious, still looks like a pretty good price. And then a couple other guys just fell in. You know, Derek Norris fell in for 12, and I actually stuck him at first base because in tout it's a 15-game eligibility. And then I got Miguel Montero for 11, and... You know, Tout Wars has a rule in the only leagues called the swingman rule where you can have essentially two utility players or two players at any position. Todd Zola of Masters Ball pulled this four-catcher strategy gambit off 4 years ago. And the way I was looking at it was, you know, the NL is so thin at the end. Now, one thing about what I did, there were some people saying, well, you know, stars and scrubs is the way to go. Doing a balanced roster isn't really the way to go. That's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is at the bottom, it's so weak in the National League that there's no guarantee these players you spend a dollar or two are going to do anything more than earn that dollar or two. And that's kind of the way I was looking at it. I was looking at it like, well, if I buy this balanced team and if everybody or almost everybody on my team is a little bit undervalued, I should still come out with a pretty decent team. And it's, you know, if it's four catchers, you know, like Derek Norris is kind of an example. It's like, okay, Derek Norris at first base is not your optimal guy to have at first base. But given the lack of quality first baseman, you know, you're really worse off with, say, Norris, you know, as in your first base slot. And somebody else, you know, like John Segura, who I got at shortstop at 13 for a combined like 25, you know, versus like, for example, Darren Ruff for $2 on somebody else's team and like a $20, you know, second baseman.
Yeah, we actually talked a bit about that, how weak the bottom of the pool is in the NL going into the draft a little bit before it. So, yeah, I agree with that.
So I want to talk a little bit about your pitching staff first, because your pitching staff is really, really strong in this league, at least in my opinion. You've got the two closers, but you've got this Adam Wainwright, Steven Matz, Shelby Miller, Aaron Nola combo from 1 through 4. And really just scanning the rest of the rosters in this league, I don't think, I mean, other than the top four that Todd Zola has, and he has John Lester, Carlos Martinez, John Lackey, and Wei-Yin Chen. Other than that, I don't think there's a stronger front end of rotation, and you spent a bit less than he did. Also, you didn't. Then there was Lenny, who bought three of the aces.
It has a bunch of $1 guys. Yeah,
yeah, that's a different strategy altogether. I mean, that's all fine and good, but when you're rostering Tony Cingrani, Chad Qualls, Kevin Segrist, and Sung Hwan Oh, and Jason Ma, he's like rebuilding every Cardinals bullpen of the last 4 years. You know, when you end up with that on the back end, it's either an interesting strategy or a poor planning. But talk to me about your starting pitching, because it's got upside, and it's deep, and I think it's something that can really carry your team.
Well, you know, something that I did plan to do when I talked earlier about stars and scrubs and worrying about that, I thought I was going to have a $200 offense based on how Tout had behaved before. I thought I was going to get some expensive hitters. I bought Kershaw last year for 37. I had a feeling that somebody was going to bid him up to like the low 40s, and Derek Carty got him for 41. So I was like, okay, you know, I'm going to go low end on pitching. And it played out that way at the beginning. You know, all the guys that went over 20, and you mentioned some of them already, you know, went for price or a little bit over. And Adam Wainwright, you know, I got Nola for 9, just because I think he came out at a weird time. But then Wainwright was the next pitcher starter I got. And, you know, we've talked about Wainwright on the show. You know, you and I, Brett, both really like him. You know, I don't know what your price was on him in mixed, and, you know, you probably just missed out on him too. But I had a feeling, based on how this league is, that he wasn't going to go for more than 18. And 18 was my price on him, and I was really, you know, happy to get him. And I think people ignore the fact that, you know, he's coming off of a non-arm injury. The arm injury he had, he's had a year to rest off of. You know, there's some risk, as there's risk with any pitcher. But he really has that potential to be an ace, and he's going for it. You know, the strikeouts aren't quite there, but he's going for a non-ace price. You know, Matz is kind of the same thing. You know, Shelby Miller, you know, it really depends on what you believe with him. You know, his DRA last year was terrific. You know, he could be a little bit, you know, less than that, but he's my third starter. He's certainly not the ace. You know, I'm kind of glad you mentioned Lenny and some of these other teams. Something I feel gets lost with pitching is that it's easy to look at these aces and think they're automatic. We know they're not. We know there are going to be some pitchers who are going to either get hurt or fail, and right now they're being treated like they're automatic, and that's something I kind of do like about my staff. I'm spreading the risk, but I also feel like I have some really good pitchers. You know, when Aaron Nola is your four, that's pretty solid.
Yeah, I completely agree. Let's go full circle on the pitching staff. Tell us what you like about Jared Eichhoff and Taylor Youngman to you know, two young starters on rebuilding squads in the NL.
Well, you know, I got to see Eichhoff here a couple times in Philadelphia, and you know, he really worked hard. He developed the slider into even more of an outpitch than it already was. There's certainly some risk with him in terms of durability. He already has had a thumb problem this spring. He should be fine. You know, he's not going to put up a sub-3 like he put up last year. The league's taking another look at him. But with the stuff he has in pitching in the NL East, I could see him putting up a 3.5 with a decent whip. That seems fairly realistic. And, you know, for a guy at $5, if he doesn't work out and he slips a little bit, I feel fairly comfortable replacing him. Taylor Youngman I got for $1 at the end. He's my sixth starter. What I'm hoping to do is kind of cycle him in and out for matchups like I did last year with a couple of other of my low-end pitchers. You know, the difference last year is I had a lot of those guys, you know, if you remember, that I was doing that with. Hopefully Youngman's the only one that I have to do that with.
Yeah, I think, you only took one potential starter on your reserves. I think, you know, knowing your strategy, I think you're going to end up doing a bit of cycling, and those guys aren't going to stick around for too long.
No, and something this year to explain to our listeners is that it's a $1,000 budget, and they got rid of Vickery, but there's still $0 and $1 bids. So it's going to be very easy potentially to cycle through pitchers and to fab pitchers as need be.
Mm-hmm. So going to the offense now, you know, if you remove the catchers from the equation, you did not spend more than $13 on any position player, but you did not spend less than $7 on any position player. Actually, I take that back. Matt Duffy was $15. He was scrolled up by there. So $7 to $15 was really the sweet spot there. Are there any particular guys who you bought on offense who you feel really good about, or do you just feel do you like it in the aggregate more?
It's definitely a team to like in the aggregate. These are all players who kind of fit a value proposition. There are a couple guys with upside, like Adonis Garcia. If he sticks, you know, if the power last year is somewhat real, could be a bit of a bargain at $7. The change of scenery for John Segura could help. You know, and even in an OBP league, 13 is kind of the floor. But that's really the key with this team. For a lot of these players, where I purchase them is sort of their floor. Now, obviously, any player could crap out or not work out. But if you look at these players across the board, you know, Angel Pagan's an example at $9. I'm not really excited by him, but that's pretty much what he earned last year in an OBP format, even doing absolutely nothing. So if these players show up and if they play and they grind it out, they all have the potential to do this. And all I'm really hoping for is that a handful of them do more than this. You know, Brandon Phillips and Matt Duffy are examples of players who earned more than this last year. I'm not expecting a repeat, particularly for Phillips, given his age. I don't see the speed really coming back. But that's kind of the expectation with an offense like this. I spent a little under $160. They can't all par out or I'll have a problem. But if three or four of them can earn, you know, like $5 to $10 over what I paid for them, which, you know, certainly can happen, then I'll have a good offense. And the other thing, Brett, that this team is the polar opposite of your mixed team in terms of what I'm hoping for. I'm looking at a pitching staff that, you know, hopefully can get 55 points out of a possible 60. What I'm looking at with the offense is not going to sweep any categories barring a major luck. I'm hoping for 35, 36 points, which sounds like might be impossible if you look at the players. But in the aggregate, I should be strong in runs. I should be strong in runs batted in. And, you know, all I really need with everything else is just to kind of have an average performance.
Well, all you need are these guys to play, right? I mean, that's the plan.
Well, that's the plan. And the other part of it, too, and George, I know you alluded to this before with the National League, you're talking about a team or a situation for some teams where they're going to have three or four guys doing absolutely nothing to start. And to circle back for a second with the catchers, some of the plan there, you know, it's I think Joe Pisapia of Sirius has called this drowning the pool, you know, and he's talked about it in a mixed league. But if you do this in an only, there are teams out there, you know, if you go out there and look at the spreadsheet, there's teams out there that have absolutely no catchers and are going to be carrying two dead spots for a while. And that's kind of a little subtle advantage of doing what I did and, you know, when I kind of decided to make this adjustment. And yeah, Brett, you're absolutely right, though. This is a volume play. You know, I do have Jose Reyes who, you know, carries some risk. Even in an NL only, I did want to get some upside. And that was kind of the play with him of, well, you know, if he comes back, you know, in 50 or 60 games as opposed to 80 games, and, you know, if he's, you know, relatively productive Jose Reyes. Jose Reyes was, you know, as much as he's fallen off, he was the sixth best shortstop in mixed leagues last year. You know, there's still some play there in fantasy.
Yeah, I think there's more upside than you're selling on this team. I think, you know, a lot of it does come in the catcher position, but I think Lucroy and Grandal both carry upside at those prices.
Yeah.
I'm in agreement with you that Segura at that point is really solid, because I do think his defense is going to keep him in the lineup pretty much every day, and with the speed and the quality of the lineup that they have in Arizona, I think he could pretty easily be a $15 to $17 player. I like Estrubel Cabrera a lot if he can, will himself to not miss much time to start the year. We've talked about Ben Paulson. I think Paulson has sort of sneaky upside, where he's not going to be a guy who comes out and hits 25 homers or steals any bases, but he can, you know, he can get on base at a good clip and add a lot in counting stats. Playing on that team against right-handed pitching, and I still have not. We talked about Jose Reyes, but I still have not given up on the Yasmani Tomas train. I still think that he can turn into a good hitter and a good power hitter too. Everyone's sort of running the other way on him, and honestly, I don't even remember if he was taken in the mixed auction. I'm looking now to see if he was, because I can't. He was. He was taken in the reserve round. So he was taken in the second round of the reserve round.
You're right. My concern. I'm kind of just looking at it from both sides. My concern with this team. You know, people often ask, do you like your team? And the obligatory answer is yes. This is a hard team to like. There's a lot of potential. Like, I see the potential for upside, but particularly with an older player like Phillips, I see the potential, and Pagan is another example. I see the potential for downside as well. So I hear what you're saying, and, you know, I definitely appreciate it. And again, you know, the point to kind of make about this, by my values, and, you know, that's always the, you know, important thing when we talk about this, every player with the exception of John Jay, who I bought at par because I didn't want to leave the room with money, and he was the last starter out there, or the last, you know, definitive starter out there on the good side of platoon, was a profit of a dollar more. So yeah, there's profit by my lights to be had here, but as we know, you know, things go wrong, you know, you don't generate that profit.
And this struck me, I mean, the more I look at it, it's the ultimate example of trusting your values and your bid limits and sticking rigidly to that and trusting that your process going in is right. I think that's going to play out for you. At the end of the day, I think it's a good team. The more I look at it, I mean, the more I like it. I didn't at first, you know, when everything first happened with the draft, I was like, oh, I don't know about this team. But the more I look at it in comparison to some of the other teams, you're at least getting production at each spot, whereas there aren't a whole lot of weaknesses here. And the pitching staff is obviously really, really good. I think that's going to carry you. I love the closer combination with Familia and Melanson, and then you pair that with Casilla. He's, you know, I really like what you did with that, so...
Well, thanks. And, you know, something else to keep in mind, I made the rounds this morning on some of the, you know, on Sirius, and I did another podcast. This is a trading league. This is an NFBC where you have to have balance and there's no trading. And the only way to improve your team is via FAB. So I've had a better luck in Tout Wars in last year when I won and I was first in offense. And I was able to trade some offense for pitching, and then I leveraged that to trade Noah Syndergaard for three closers. I have confidence I'll be able to trade a catcher or two if I need to do it. And I have confidence that I'd like to build a lead in saves with those three closers and then trade one at some point in June, you know, assuming all three hold on to the job. And you know, something that's underestimated about Familia Melanson, they'll bring value in ERA and WHIP, and that's part of what I was looking at. One thing that happened at the end of this auction, I don't know if you noticed, in labor, a lot of these crummy closers slipped, like J.J. Hoover went for two, Fernando Rodney went for four. In Tout, a lot of these guys went for what I consider price, like J.J. Hoover went for seven, Jason Grilli went for seven, Will Smith went for seven, Fernando Rodney went for eight. Now, that doesn't mean that they could be bargains, and, you know, we know that, but they could also just completely fall off the map in April or early May. So when you take that into context, I like the fact that not just Casilla, who I think is better than a lot of those guys I mentioned, but Familia Melanson, you know, anybody could lose their job, but they could be among the best closers in the National League this year.
Yeah, and there's, you know, there's really no, there's no other team that that double dipped on, unless I'm missing something, there was no other team that double dipped on closers to that extent. So that should give you a leg up as you push towards building a little bit of a cushion in that category. I mean, really, just Andy Behrens took Brad Ziegler and Jake McGee, and they're fine. They're fine enough as closers, but that that combo is certainly not the same.
Yeah, a lot of teams took either one solid closer and a flyer or a low end closer. You know, a couple teams, you know, just dump saves. Lenny Melnick has, you know, I've joked, has dump saves, like, you know, since the Eisenhower administration. Lenny, if you're listening, that's not a crack on your age, just a crack on the fact that you don't buy closers. And Brian Walton took Tony Watson and Sergio Romo. And you know, it's funny, at the end I was thinking about Romo or Watson to pair with one of my guys, but again, because I had three closers, I decided to go with Youngman instead.
Yeah, that's that's always the better philosophy, I think, especially, you know, in any kind of format. I mean, you talk about people liking to handcuff their closers, but you know, even with the additional expense, you're cutting your risk way more by buying a third closer than you mm-hmm. are by spending that money trying to handcuff someone. And these handcuff guys aren't cheap. I mean, if you wanted to, even just looking at what they added up to, if you wanted to get Jason Grilli and Aroldis Vizcaíno, they went for a combined $14. If you wanted to get Will Smith and Jeremy Jeffress, they went for a combined $11. And you got Casilla for $9, and that's, you know, that's a better use of money. And yeah, there are exceptions to that. I mean, I know I handcuff. I say this as I was the one who handcuffed Drew Storen with Roberto Osuna, but I think that's the only situation in baseball that I would handcuff a closer.
Well, you know, something that Chris Liston did in the American League, I don't know if you saw this, guys, he put together the Yankee bullpen.
Yeah.
So he put together Betances, Andrew Miller, and Aroldis Chapman for 38 combined. They earned 42 combined without their saves last year. So there's value if you do it with guys like that, but that's an exception just based on how amazing that bullpen is.
We almost saw the all Dodger pitching staff with Derek Curry. Yeah, that was a fun one to watch.
Yeah, you know, it's if Kazmir is healthy, and I saw the velocity was back up, you know, that could be okay. I don't really mind it, and you know, his team is certainly kind of interesting. You know, it was funny because I was sitting next to Derek. And he was one of the three people who, and Scott Wildman was the other one, who had a good amount of money, you know, and I was sitting back, so I was kind of in that position. this is also where, you know, valuation and pricing kind of comes into play. So I wasn't next to Scott, so I don't know how he was feeling, but I could see Derek was getting kind of frustrated. And it's not a knock on Derek. I think anybody in this position, if you're not a valuation person, can get frustrated because you can feel like, oh, how am I going to get my players? Or you push on somebody you don't want. I think he got Will Myers for 16 and was a little frustrated by that because he didn't want him. And I got Adonis Garcia. I know Derek's been all over Adonis Garcia this spring. He got him in labor. You know, and after I got him for 7, you know, I said 7 really quick because I knew Derek liked him, and I think Derek paid like 5 for him in labor. So I just wanted to kind of take it out of his hands. You know, and afterward he said to me, you know, would you have gone 8? And I said no. You know, that just annoyed him even more. So, you know, some of the valuation thing, and you know, you mentioned this, Brett, on your mixed. If you have that gut feel for your numbers, is great. But for me, you know, just having a set idea in mind. You know, and I kind of went off the map a little bit with Lucroy, and I went off the map a little bit with John Jay. But on the whole, you wind up with a team. You have one or two players like that, but you wind up with a team you feel good about. And, you know, if your valuations are wrong and if your projections are wrong, well, that could happen, but that could happen anyway.
Yeah, it absolutely could. There's no way to absolutely prevent that from happening.
No, I think, you know, Tristan Cockcroft wrote something at ESPN where he was talking about how, you know, even the best experts are like wrong like 30% of the time when it comes to their projections.
Mm-hmm. That makes total sense. So how do you? Well, I'll ask you the obvious question. How do you feel coming out of the auction? You feel you feel good?
I feel better talking to you guys. I did my write-up today, and it's going up Wednesday at Baseball Prospectus. But when I looked at this team, I sort of felt like, well, you know, this is a good team. I could see it finishing third or fourth. I'm not sure I could see it winning. But you know, on the other hand, even if I have a mishap or two, something I learned last year, I got better at, you know, being aggressive on guys in the DL and guys in the minors. Like I got better at using Baseball Prospectus's stash list to kind of find people. Kyle Schwarber is the only significant stash I missed out on last year. So I like the fact that I have this balance. And if one or two guys don't work out, I can kind of fill in. I feel like unlike some of these other teams, like Rick Guyfel is an example. He snagged me on 3 outfielders. He snagged me on Charlie Blackmon, Carlos Gonzalez, and Yoenis Cespedes. And at the time, I was frustrated by that. But the cost to him of that, if you look at his infield is, well, he's got Freddie Freeman, which is great. But then he's got Will Middlebrooks, Josh Bell, Chase Utley, Trevor Story, and Adani Hechavarria. So there's kind of a cost to going stars and scrubs. And you know, some of that cost is if a couple of those guys, like, you know, I think Utley, Middlebrooks, and Bell in particular, do nothing, he's going to have a lot of holes. And at the beginning of the season, that gives me an advantage in that I'll be producing stats from most of these slots, with the exception of Reyes, every day. And building that cushion early, you know, things happen. If things go wrong, I can pick guys up fairly aggressively, which I did last year, to make sure that doesn't go away. So yeah, you know, you guys kind of talked me into it. The more I look at this, I think this team can be competitive.
So on a scale of 1 to Drake LaRoche, how do you feel about your chances to repeat?
is 1 like the best on this, or is 1 the worst?
No, Drake LaRoche is the best.
Oh, Drake. I can't even say his name anymore. I got, so we should do like a Drake LaRoche podcast and do all our hot takes.
The Drake meter.
I would probably say an 8. You know, I've had better auctions. You know, what's funny is about that question you asked, Brett. I went back last year and I looked at the auction I put together. And it's always, this has probably happened to you, Brett, and I'm sure this happened to you, George, in any league you've won. Go back and look at the 5 worst things that you did the year before and tell yourself, well, you know, if those 5 things come to fruition, would I have won? So last year, if you told me that I would have bought Doug Fister, Andrew Kashner, and Youngjin Ryu for like a combined, I think it was like $35, and told me that my catchers, Devin Mesorasco and Juan Rosario, at a combined 29 would earn like 3, well, it was a little more, but you earn like $5, I'm like, all right, well, I'm going to finish in 9th place. There's no way I'm going to win this league. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I won. So it's the whole thing about that question. Like, I feel pretty good about this. And, you know, maybe you guys are right. Like, maybe I should feel a little better, because one thing I did do with this team is I did kind of spread the risk. Like, as much as I lament not getting Paul Goldschmidt, you know, for Steve, and, you know, Steve Garner's, you know, we've had him on the show recently. He's terrific. You know, if Paul Goldschmidt gets hurt in May and is out for like 3 months, Steve's probably out of luck. Whereas if one of my guys, you know, if John Segura gets hurt and misses 3 months, it'll sting a little bit, but it's not going to be the end of the world for me.
Yeah. So that was some good tout discussion. So we will take a quick break and we'll come back and wrap things up. Welcome back. Thank you for listening to episode 82 of Flags Fly Forever. We have been a Baseball Perspectives Fantasy Podcast. I am Brett. Mike is Mike. George is George. We will be back again for one more episode, I believe, before the start of the regular season. And then all of this draft crap goes entirely out the window. But that's the whole fun of March, is that you obsess over this and you put all this effort into your draft and your auction, and then it's the middle of April, and then you're just freaking out because one of your guys isn't hitting, or one of your guys is hurt, or one of your guys who you thought was going to be terrible is now awesome, and that's why we do this. That's why this is fun. But we will see you then, and enjoy your one of your last weeks of spring training. Have a good week. Bye.